Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Rand Fishkin, and we will speak with him about his international bestseller, Lost and Founder.
I was in a little bit of a strange position in my career. You know, I had founded this company, Moz, a software tech startup, and run it as CEO for 7 years. And then I stepped down. I found that my, my contributions and opinions inside the business were not taken as seriously. I think there was some perception that maybe I had misled the company my last couple of years in as CEO, and so I needed something else to do, right? I needed some other way to contribute. And my hope with Lost and Founder was to take a lot of the stories and lessons that I think I had misinterpreted and potentially presented wrongly over the years, and repackage those in a way that told the whole story. I tend to be very transparent. I bias that way, but Lost and Founder was certainly, it had a little bit more freedom because it had the benefit of historical perspective, right? I got to look back on my career and the growth of this company, the challenges the company had gone through to get to where it was. And because of that, I think the reflection of here's what we did and here's how it affected the years ahead was very different from the blog posts and videos and, you know, interviews and stuff that I had done over the years, which were very much in the moment, right? Hey, here's this thing we did and it worked. We did it last month. As opposed to, oh, 3 years ago when we did this thing, it looked like it worked. And then this year, as we're reflecting on it, it's. I think it was actually the wrong decision, and here's why. And that historical perspective can be invaluable, right? Because for many business owners, I think that the way to connect is with data and stories. And so Lost and Founder tries to have both of those.
Rand Fishkin is the co-founder and CEO of SparkToro. He has dedicated his professional life to helping people do better marketing through his blogging, videos, speaking, and his book, Lost and Founder. Believe it or not, Rand dropped out of the University of Washington in 2000 to work full-time at his mother's small business marketing firm as a web designer. In 2004, he created SEO Moz blog, which over the next decade became the world's most popular community and content resource for search marketeers. Founded in 2007, Rand grew Moz from 7 employees to 134, revenues from $800,000 to $29.3 million, and traffic from 1 to 30 million annual visitors. Rand stepped down as CEO in February of 2014 during a rough bout with depression and left the company 4 years later. He remains chairman of Moz's board. Rand is also the co-founder of Inbound.org. Rand may be best known for his popular blogs and regular Whiteboard Friday series, watched by tens of thousands of marketeers each week. In 2018, Rand founded SparkToro and published with Penguin Random House, Lost and Founder, a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. He has been profiled in Seattle Times, named to Business Week's 30 Under 30, written about in Newsweek, The Next Web, The Inc. 500, at which Moz was named 5 years in a row now, and hundreds of other publications. He is, however, most proud of his prominent appearances in his wife Geraldine's first book, All Over the Place. Geraldine and Rand are also small investors in Tiny Seed Accelerator, Techstart Seattle, and Backstage Capital. Now, onto this inspiring and surprisingly candid episode with Rand Fishkin. Rand, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you on the show, and I really mean it because I have been one of those millions of people who have benefited from your writing in the past, and I continue to follow you. I don't know whether you know, I continue to write about stuff you write on my LinkedIn posts from time to time, and I really wanted to talk to you about your book, Lost and Founder. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Supanjan. It's an honor to be here.
Nobody can blame you for not writing. So what prompted you to think of writing a book?
Yeah, well, I was in a little bit of a strange position in my career. You know, I had founded this company, Moz, a software tech startup, and run it as CEO for 7 years. And then I stepped down from that role and was, you know, trying to contribute to the company. But a few years into that kind of secondary role, I found that my contributions and opinions inside the business were not taken as seriously. I think there was some perception that maybe I had misled the company my last couple years as CEO. And so I needed something else to do, right? I needed some other way to contribute. And my hope, you know, my hope with Lost and Founder was to take a lot of the stories and lessons that I think I had misinterpreted and potentially presented wrongly over the years, and repackage those in a way that told the whole story, right? That told the good side and the bad side. And so Lost and Founder has this, you know, very, very transparent approach to it.
Yeah, so that was another thing that struck me when I read the book. Did you have to decide to make it that transparent, or it just came naturally to you?
I mean, I think for folks who've read my writing, I tend to be very transparent. I bias that way. But Lost and Founder was certainly, it had a little bit more freedom because it had the benefit of historical perspective, right? I got to look back on my career and the growth of this company, the challenges the company had gone through to get to where it was. And because of that, I think the reflection of here's what we did and here's how it affected the years ahead was very different from the blog posts and videos and, you know, interviews and stuff that I had done over the years, which were very much in the moment, right? Hey, here's this thing we did and it worked. We did it last month. As opposed to, oh, 3 years ago when we did this thing, it looked like it worked. And then this year, as we're reflecting on it, it's I think it was actually the wrong decision, and here's why. And that, I think that historical perspective can be invaluable, right? Because for many business owners, I think that the way to connect is with data and stories. And so Lost and Founder tries to have both of those, right? Here's something that a lot of startups experience. Here's how they tend to perform. Here's what correlates with performance. And now here's my story about it.
You did speak very candidly about other people in your life as well, who were also going through this with you. So did you sort of talk to them about writing it this way? I mean, I presume you would have, but how did that go actually?
That a very wise question. I don't think anyone's asked me that before, and it was challenging, very, very challenging. Supanjan, we had months of back and forth, actually between my personal attorney and Moz's attorney, the company's attorney, who the CEO had hired, and there were. Gosh, I think it was 9 months of back and forth about the book and what was being said in there, all that kind of thing. And I ended up agreeing to provide them with the draft, the rough draft of the book, all the parts that mentioned the CEO and I think other board members prior to publication. So they got to review that. I think once they did, they sort of, you know, it allayed their fears a little bit, right? Because they don't, I don't think anyone comes out looking bad, right? It just looks messy and complicated and hard, which it was. And so that, but that was very, very tense and fraught and high drama. My editor at Penguin Random House, Nikki Papadopoulos, she, you know, she went through that with me and sort of had this high tension feeling. I can remember a lot of conversations over that year that were tough.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So coming back to the book, Rand, I mean, you decided at some point that you want to tell this story. I mean, this is when you had sort of disengaged from the day-to-day activities and you are sort of thinking about staying or leaving, I guess.
And
you said that, okay, I need to do something with this time by that before I decide. And I'm presuming this was before you had arrived at the idea of SparkToro and what you, I mean, that idea might be there, but the fact that you will move and do something with it, possibly it was before that when you decided, okay, I want to write this book.
Yeah, that's right. It was much earlier than SparkToro. So, you know, at the end of Lost and Founder, it's not a spoiler, but, you know, the last chapter or afterward includes a little bit about how I've started this, you know, when you read this book, I'll have started this new company.
Right.
And that was added in, you know, that was added on to the end of the book just prior to publication in 2018. Hmm. So it was, you know, I was writing the book in 2016 and 17.
Right.
And then basically it was, you know, published thereafter. So yeah, that's the book was conceived long before I knew that I was going to be leaving Moss.
Right. And obviously a lot of this analysis was already going through your mind. It was not about, I'm going to write this and share this, but okay, this decision 3 years back I thought was correct, but 3 years down the line we figured that that was not such a great decision and so on. Especially your, you know, those promotional deals and all that you write about, right? Quite early in the book.
Right. Some of the acquisitions. Yeah. I think a lot of the strategic decisions that seem like they're the right way to go, but then end up being wrong. The funding, right? I think venture funding was probably the wrong path for us. And if you look back, you can sort of see that now.
Yes. So I have two questions over there. One is that when you were conceiving the book, how did you think that this will sort of get structured out? Or was it that you started writing the highlights that were in your mind and then as an afterthought you put it together?
Right, yeah. So funny enough, I pitched the book to publishers, you know, went to New York, sat down with some publishers, pitched the book, that and at that time pitched it quite differently, pitched it much more personal narrative style, much less, you know, here's sort of lessons and, you know, there was much less research and data that ended up being in a number of the chapters. And so the outline was different, right? The narrative arc of the story was different. And Penguin Random House initially, right, they bought the book in that original format. And I wrote the first almost half of it, I think first five chapters of that other book, sent it to my editor. And I remember in June of that year, she called me up and she was like, this is not the right book. We're not writing the correct book here. We're going to have to change it.
Oh, really?
And I remember, And I remember just being, you know, so upset, so frustrated that we couldn't have identified that in the outline as opposed to waiting until I'd written all these chapters.
Right.
Especially because I knew I only had, you know, now I only had 6 months to get the rest of the first version of the rough draft done. But I think it ended up being a much better book as a result, right? So it was formulated one way, formulated very much as a personal narrative, and personal story. And that still makes its way into the book, right? As, as you noted, Lost and Founder still has very much of a story, but it's far less a single arc and much more, you know, hey, let's extract out a particular lesson from these various growth stages and tell the story of these particular incidents that'll be useful to the reader. I think this is what Nikki, my editor, correctly identified, right? Is that rather than you telling your story, which maybe is interesting and valuable to you, let's tell only those bits of the story that the reader really wants to hear. Let's serve the reader better. And I think that ended up being a much better book.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, from what you tell me, it sounds... although I'll read the other book too, by the way. but yeah, I mean, I understand if you're thinking of a wider audience and people who want to relate. So relatability possibly comes from... Although I think you are an extremely relatable person because people are watching your videos like in millions every week. So I still believe that your story would have been relatable. But I do understand the logic, and I do understand that it would possibly make it relatable at a very personal level, not relatable as in, I watch this person and I've learned so much from this person, and so this is his story as against this is what I can do from his learning.
Yes, yes. And I think, look, I think that while a personal story might be interesting, it might be fun, it might have some drama, it is not nearly as useful. And I think that on reflection, right, my goal is not to amplify myself, not to become, you know, a bigger personality or build my personal brand. Those are not, you know, those are not particularly interesting to me. My goal instead is to help as many people as I can, especially entrepreneurs and, you know, folks who are in early stage, young companies, small companies. And that's just because I, you know, at my core, I think a healthy economy, a healthy world is built by more people being able to build the businesses that they want in the way that they want, and more small businesses surviving as opposed to the world we're living in, which is sort of big business dominating everything and having so many unfair advantages. And so, I'm trying to, you know, contribute in my small way to maybe a little more small business, entrepreneurial business having a chance.
So that brings me to the second question about venture capital. So by this time, when you were writing the book, you had sort of changed your mind about venture capital, quote unquote.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
What sort of led you to that? I mean, was it...
It wasn't purely, you know, I think you could come away from the book feeling like, hey, Rand had a bad experience, a negative experience with venture capital, and therefore decided, well, if it's not for me, it's not right for anyone else either. And that's not the message I'm trying to convey, right? I think what almost every venture capital investor would tell you is venture capital is wrong for 99% of companies, right? That's a line I've heard from every investor out there. And yet, the problem is it's marketed to 100% of tech companies, right? 100% of tech founders. Right. And we desperately need alternatives to that. And I think part of that starts with a conversation about why venture capital can be so dangerous and high risk and potentially not lucrative even in the way that it's thought of, right? I think that a lot of folks who are familiar with my story and Maz's story, you know, I still get this all the time, right? People Google Rand Fishkin net worth, right? They search for that, and then they, you know, they find an article which is totally wrong, right? That says that I have millions of dollars or something, right? And then they email me and say, hey, would you like to, you know, invest in my company or support this or that? And I have to reply with, hey, maybe my shares in Moz someday will be worth some money, but it's also very possible that they won't be. And so I have no liquid capital, I just have this amount of stock. And that is true for so many founders, right? Mm. That they either own illiquid stock or that they have built something that if they owned it themselves, or even if they, you know, had raised a lot of debt, or had raised angel money, or had structured a partnership, or, you know, any of these other various kinds of investment that could have funded their companies, they would be doing extraordinarily well, right? They and their employees and their team would be doing very well. They're, you know, they could serve their customers better. They could serve their employees better. But because they've raised investment in this particular fashion, everything becomes much harder because they have to chase massive, rapid growth rates and put growth ahead of profitability.
Yes.
Right. And so because of that, you get into a lot of situations where businesses have to do, you know, big layoffs because they've overextended and haven't been able to find that growth, or they just die completely, which, hey, if you and I are venture capitalists, we're going to go out, raise a fund of, you know, $100 million. We'll go put that money to work in maybe, let's say we invest in 100 companies, just for easy math. 95 of those, 93 of those will die, right? We expect them to just not make it. They won't last 5 years. They'll go out of business. Maybe they'll be acquired for, you know, parts. They won't even make their money back for us. Two or three of those companies will do pretty well, and then one or two will make the whole portfolio.
Yeah.
Right? And so that works fine for us. You know, for you and I as investors, that works okay. The math works out. Yes. For founders, there's five happy founders and 95 very unhappy founders.
Yes.
Right? There's five happy teams and 95 times whatever, you know, 100 employees each. Well, maybe 20 to 50 employees each, very unhappy, right? There's tens of thousands of customers served by those 95 businesses that are no longer being served by them.
Yes.
And so, you know, you get, and of course, as a result, this, going back to what we talked about earlier, this props up a world where a few businesses are the winners and everyone else is a loser.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that is the opposite of the world I want, right? Mm. So I think it's that experience of over the course of a couple of decades in the working world, realizing I don't want to become whatever, another Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, even, you know, Twitter or Salesforce, right? That's not what I'm excited to build. I want 1,000 small businesses that are awesome and doing well, not one big one. And, you know, so I think venture capital is not a philosophically correct model for what I want in the world. And it's not a great mathematical model for having success. And it's not a great way to get rich.
Right, right.
It's time for a short break. We will continue this discussion on why venture capital is perhaps not what the world needs and how data shows, contrary to popular belief, raising venture capital is the best way to build a successful business and get rich is far from true. Be with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. As we went into the break, Rand started speaking about the research that he conducted with public data and how it showed that in a world where few businesses are winners and everyone else is a loser, it is difficult to get rich on the back of venture capital investments because 95% owned.
And the math is there in the book.
Yeah, and the math is there. I mean, one of the things that I did on the research side of things was to look at a lot of the data out there about how well do small and medium businesses do? What are the survival rates like? And, you know, even though when you raise venture capital, everybody congratulates you, they probably shouldn't be, right? You've just taken your odds of surviving for 5 years and cut them by, you know, nearly an order of magnitude down.
Right. Yeah, so that's another thing, right? The media over glorifies funding against revenue.
Yes. I mean, if you take your small business and you post on your LinkedIn, right?
Yeah.
Hey, we had $250,000 of profit this year, right? Very successful year for us. Amazing. You'll get a few people who are like, oh, congratulations. Well done. Yeah, nice. But if you go out and say, oh, we raised $2.5 million.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, you're going to get all the press and all the congratulations. That's weird. That's really weird.
Yes, it is. And I completely agree with that sentiment. In fact, my personal mission is to talk about revenue. Startups should only think of revenue. I mean, that takes care. If you're getting revenue, means you're serving your customers. Somebody's paying you.
That's what's awesome, right? Revenue isn't just revenue and profit are not just signals of a business's sort of return to their founders, right? It means you're employing people and those people are doing work that other people value and you are helping someone in some way, right? Yes. The beautiful thing about capitalism is that you can be potentially greedy and self-serving and serve others at the same time.
Right.
And revenue is a really good way to look at that, especially when you're small. But, you know, things get weird as financial machinations come into play.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I would like to talk to you about two chapters specifically, which you may want to talk about. One is the Beware the Pivot.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we start there? Why did you think you had to write this chapter?
Yeah, I was trying to identify a lot of the things that were tempting but dangerous in the world of startups and entrepreneurship. And among those was one that certainly tempted us and that we attempted ourselves at one point, and that is this concept, I think, that made its way around, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs' mindsets throughout the last 10-15 years, which is this idea of pivoting. If your startup isn't working, right, your business isn't working, you're not finding customers or you can't find them affordably, hey, let's pivot to something else. And a few famous examples are always held up as these sort of, oh, well, you know, before Uber was Uber, Travis had this other idea. And before Pinterest was Pinterest, they had this other idea. And same with Twitter, right? And so you have these few businesses that everyone points to and says, look, you can be a huge success. And so what I went out and did is looked at how many companies really had successfully pivoted their model. And the number is vanishingly small. The number who survived is vanishingly small. The pivot tends to actually be much more dangerous than people think. And so my advice in there is actually to consider pivoting small pieces of your business, but not big ones, right? Instead of looking at, hey, let's change what we're doing, who we're serving them, how we're positioned, and how we're marketing, maybe just try changing one of those things.
Right. Great. The other one, and this is sort of a broader question, the other chapter I wanted to talk to you about was the one which talks about scalable marketing flywheels and growth hacks. So my question is, you know, growth hacking has become a thing, right? If you go to LinkedIn, you'll find some very respectable people with fairly decent backgrounds now classifying themselves as growth hackers. I'm not even talking of the younger crowd doing digital marketing and stuff like that. So So do you actually think that this is a thing?
Yes, it is a thing, okay. Right? It's something that certainly people have invested in and attempted. I think the problem, again, is the mindset, the belief that if we find one correct growth hack that works for us in the short term, that will power us through the process of needing marketing at all. Hmm. And again, you know, a few famous examples are held up in the growth hacking world as these sort of representations of what you can achieve if you just find the right growth hack.
Right.
When reality is very different, right? The reality is not that finding the growth hack works even for those companies, right? The Facebook growth hack of, you know, going to universities, or the Dropbox growth hack of the double referral.
Right.
Those things were essentially just small inputs in a larger marketing engine, a flywheel that was already turning. And I think, unfortunately, that story gets eclipsed by the growth hacking one. And so a lot of founders, a lot of entrepreneurs, particularly those who aren't marketers by trade, think of marketing as, oh, I just have to find one growth hack, one growth channel that'll work for me, and then the rest, you know, the rest will come. When in fact, the right thing to do is to find and build a great flywheel, and then, and then find where it's experiencing friction and apply a hack, a growth hack, to that area of friction.
Right, right. I completely agree with that one. The last chapter I would like to, you know, sort of hear you talk about is the one where you say great products are really minimally viable. Minimally viable. And I so like it, because I hear this all the time about this MVP, and I sort of know about the genesis of this. I am aware of, you know, Steve Blanks and Eric Ries and Lean Movement and so on and so forth. But please tell me about your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think the MVP, right, this idea of a minimally viable product, it's not entirely wrong. I really like Eric Ries's conception around the MVP as a way to build a small, you know, relatively crappy version of a product that proves whether there is actually a need in a market. Okay. And it does it as fast as possible, right? That's the idea behind it, is you build something as fast as you can so that you don't waste time in a market or on a product that doesn't actually work for anyone, right? That no one really needs. And, you know, his sort of thinking behind this is, look, if you build a small and crappy product that kind of gets the job done in a minimally viable way, if it is a painful enough problem, there will still be some people who are interested, right? They'll be like, well, this product isn't, you know, that polished. It's not exactly what I want. But this problem that you're solving is so painful to me, I am willing to accept, you know, a very early version of a product. So here's the challenge with it, and I think the misconception behind it, is that you can apply the MVP model in other situations that are not exactly that one, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have a company that's at a later stage with more customers, launching an MVP, a new version of your product that's an MVP, which many, many companies try to do now, right, because the MVP has taken off, or launching a new product line inside a company, launching a new side project, launching a new tool, launching a new, you know, content effort, whatever it is.
Right.
Many, many companies and organizations have been taken in by this idea that the MVP applies beyond the early stage validation portion of their life cycle. Fair. And it really harms you when you do that. So we did this at Moz, and I've seen many companies do this and talk to many founders about it, right? And the problem is, you really burn your reputation as a builder of product when you launch an MVP later in your life cycle. Or if you are a startup an early stage, even very early stage startup with a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement. A great example of this is in the world of video games.
Right.
So a lot of game builders and game creators, they acquire a reputation, right? Oh, this person worked at this studio, or they made this game previously. And when they launch their first version of their new game, it doesn't get judged as, oh, yeah, I can see the promise of this eventually if they put a few more years' work into it, right? Instead, it's, oh, this is a crappy game.
That's the
experience that we all have with it. And so I think you have to be ready for that if you are using an MVP at any time other than I'm completely unknown. I, you know, barely can get one customer, never mind, 50. And I'm trying to validate whether a market exists. Outside of that context, I think you need an exceptional viable product to have a chance, because it's so hard to stand out in nearly every field these days.
I totally agree. Wonderful. So what did I miss? What is it that I didn't ask which you want to say about the book?
I think we covered a tremendous amount here. I think that we could talk about some of the team stuff. I think that in particular, the book goes pretty deep into a section on layoffs.
Right.
And obviously many, many companies are experiencing that right now in this, you know, this time of economic turmoil with the coronavirus. Those parts of the book are, I hope, still applicable, right? We did our layoffs in a good economic time when we had made poor strategic decisions and poor tactical execution. But the reality is that layoffs are always painful.
Yes.
And I think there's things that people can do that will make them harder and easier.
Yes. So let's talk about that. I think it's completely, we should talk about it, because millions of people are losing and will lose their jobs in the next, like, rapidly, right?
Yeah,
the next,
that's right.
Like, there is no forewarning. That nobody knew in the month of February that they're going to lose their job end of March.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Which is madness, right? Because we could all see the statistics about the virus coming, and yet somehow we were blindly optimistic.
Yes. Yes. So, what would you think would be the humane way of dealing with this?
Yeah, I think that a few things are really important in this particular moment. One is to recognize that in many cases, I think businesses that can weather and survive this economic downturn are going to be better off minimizing or not doing layoffs versus doing the layoffs to potentially save money. And the reason for that is many businesses will not realize the cost savings of a lost employee, right? For many, many months. And that's due to, I think, three big things, right? One is lost productivity, right? Lower productivity and output. A big one is the cost of rehiring and retraining for that position in the future, whenever you're going to do it. And the third one is the lost sort of reputation and lost whatever you want to call that, market perception.
Yes.
Right. So some companies will weather these different things better than others, and everyone has to do their own cost calculus. I think it's different for every company. But, you know, there was a great piece in the Harvard Business Review from a number of years ago, analyzing what happened to businesses that responded to recessions by cutting their workforce versus those who didn't. And the ones who did not tended to significantly overperform the competition when recovery started. Right? So just be aware of that. I think that's one thing to be aware of as an entrepreneur and business owner. The second thing I would do is, if you need to do layoffs, right? If you've done the math and you said, hey, we just don't have a choice. We don't have the thing there. I would, no matter where you are in the world, there is almost certainly a government program. That's true even here in the United States, where we have very minimal help from the government, that can assist you. Right. And so that includes things like, forgivable payroll loans and grants. That includes things like, unemployment, all sorts of programs. So I would absolutely look into those, because a lot of governments are wisely responding to this crisis with programs for small and medium businesses and entrepreneurs. And then the third thing I would say is, if you have to do these layoffs, you absolutely must step up and do them in a way that is thoughtful and empathetic. I don't know if you've seen the tech press around Bird, the scooter company here in the US, but they held a large group Zoom meeting where they laid off 400 plus of their employees with a little pre-recorded announcement. Right. Everyone was just invited to this Zoom meeting. When they got on, they were all let go. It wasn't even the CEO doing it. And of course, right, of course, this reflects horribly on the company.
Yes.
Right. It just has this, everyone in the world, in the tech world, right, can see this. And I think that now is a particularly good time to be thoughtful about your reaction, right? You be cognizant of the fact that you are releasing people into an environment of economic turmoil. Do everything that you can to help them. If you have to do layoffs, make sure that you're doing severance, right? Yes, thoughtful yes. and empathetic severance. And make sure that it's you doing it in a personal way, right? In a way that's going to be well received. I think if you explain what's going on, you'll have a different result than we did at Moz, right? If you read Lost and Founder, I think one of the biggest mistakes that we made was not to message how risky the strategy we were pursuing was, how risky the growth we were pursuing was. And therefore, when people were laid off at our company, it was a shock, right? It came as a shock to them. They didn't understand, how did we not see this coming 6 months ago? Why didn't we change direction if that was the case?
I think a lot of the cost that we talk of is one dimensional, and which is like in dollar terms. And we are not sort of accounting for the cost of reputation, the cost of human beings, the cost of development of manpower and so on. And we ignore, we tend to overvalue. It's like how we misjudge calories, right? So all calories are not the same.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Excellent analogy. I love that.
So that's the thing. And I think, so that also moves from that overall culture of, you hire when you grow and when you have money, and when you don't have money, you lay off. I think the thing has become over skewed. The process. I mean, obviously, if you as you rightly said, if you really can't carry someone on, you should let them go. But you have to have some forethought about how to ease it out for everybody.
Right, and I think it makes sense. It makes sense to message things early, right? Yes. It makes sense to be human about it, right? Yes. One of the things I am proud of Moz for doing, I thought that our CEO. At the time, did a really good job, right? Being human and explaining what had happened, being thoughtful and empathetic to people, working hard. She really worked really hard to help people get new jobs and refer them, around, give them positive, reviews and endorsements.
Right.
That's meaningful, right?
Of course.
That gets remembered too.
Of course.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Rand, thank you so much. I really enjoyed, and I couldn't have expected a better session than this. You have been
My pleasure.
As open as I would have imagined, possibly more. I really enjoyed, and I do look forward to talking to you before your next book comes out.
Well, it might be a little while, but I look forward to that as well.
Thank you
for having me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Coming up in the next episode with T.N. Hari and his book, Saying No to Jugaad, The Surprising Story of Big Basket, the Internet Grocer of India, and How It Grew with a Contrarian Approach.
I have been an active participant in the country startup ecosystem, you know, involved with, accelerators, VC funds, early stage startups. I have seen this ecosystem evolve. And in the last few years, I also realized that several unicorns were born in India. And I also realized that some of these unicorns were building unsustainable businesses. They were highly capitalized, and capital was inducing them to demonstrate bad behaviors, demonstrate building businesses which weren't having great product market fits. They were being disguised by capital. Acquiring customers through discounts. So all this, I thought, was in some ways a bit of jugaad, because valuations built this way, can come off just as easily as they get built. And we saw that happening as well. We saw Jabong valuations coming off from $1 billion to $70 million. ShopClues, was the fourth unicorn in the country, was eventually sold off for under $60 million. So I thought, BigBasket is building a business in a very sustainable way. And, valuations have not gone up as steeply as one may have seen in some other unicorns. So I think BigBasket has been built uniquely. We've never claimed to be a tech company. We've always said upfront that we are a grocer.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks with great conversations with T.N. Hari, Benjamin Hardy, Lisa Magnusson, and many more. Stay tuned. Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time, and have a wonderful day.